You wouldn't put all of your money into a single stock, would you? Well, why would you have your entire life in one single country? Why would you have all of your risk into one jurisdiction that could potentially work against you? Now, a year ago, this might have seemed like a crazy question, but today we're seeing governments around the world shut down, lock in their citizens. Many countries around the world are doing this right now. And if you haven't taken the time to think through what it takes to be a sovereign man, or I should say a sovereign individual, sovereign woman, to really be free, to be able to direct your life as you see fit without a government locking you down, without a government tracking you or trapping you in, then you need to take time to think about that. Now, somebody who's probably the most instrumental in really shaping my worldview over the last decade is someone by the name of Sovereign Man, writes a newsletter called Sovereign Man. And I've been reading it for over a decade, and I have him on the show today to talk to us about what we can do to become more sovereign, to protect our freedom, so we can have more freedom in our life. Things that we can do, think through as far as in our own state, our own country, out of the country, ways that we can protect our own sovereignty and freedom. Like I said, this is the guy that's really helped shape my worldview over the last decade. I am so happy to sit down with him today. We have so many good topics, so many questions that I had to dig through with him. So don't miss it. Let's just jump right in. Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Market Disruptor Show. And today I am joined by Simon Black. He's the founder of Sovereign Man, which is a newsletter and service that I've been subscribed to for about a dozen years. I highly recommend it. I've really been looking forward to this interview. So Simon, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks very much.
So, you know, for whatever, a decade or a dozen years, how long have you been doing it? You've been writing this newsletter, Sovereign Man, and it's really about being a sovereign man. Why don't you just kind of give us a background on what you're doing and what the Sovereign Man is about?
Well, I mean, you know, we were kind of talking about it earlier. You joked maybe I was 10 years ahead of my time. But the whole concept really was, at a certain point, I think a rational person's got to look around and say, is this something that doesn't feel right here? About a lot of things, I think, whether you're looking at the way you are personally living your life or now allowed to live your life, or if you look at financial markets or just a lot of things that don't make any sense. I mean, I think you can look at everything from stocks that trade at 1200 times earnings or bonds that have negative interest rates or banks that have negative interest rates, or the fact that, you know, you have governments that, you know, for months and months and months are telling people you weren't allowed to leave your house and go outside, or that you have to, you know, you were going to take away your freedom unless you go and get this injection. And all these sorts of things. Now we're going to go and you know, now we're going to tell we're going to tell the school children that, you know, kids as young as 4 years old, that you're either a victim or you're an oppressor. And at a certain point, I think any rational person's got to step back and go, something's wrong here. Something is seriously wrong. And I think really what we try to do is, you know, Sovereign Man sort of saw that trend quite a long time ago and just tried to articulate really about what is wrong and what's right and the different things I think that we can do about it to live a, you know, really a richer and freer life.
Yeah. One thing that I picked up from you, you know, like I said, over a decade ago, was just a simple fact, like you wouldn't put all your money in one stock. So right. Why do you have your whole life in one country? And so I've always thought about that, like as just general risk management, right?
Exactly. I mean, it's just you would diversify everything else that you know, that you have the important stuff in your life. You know, you would diversify. You wouldn't even necessarily keep all of your money in one bank. People have like different bank accounts and different places and certainly different types of investments and things like that. Not even with different stocks, but even different asset classes. Some people might own some stocks. They might own some bonds and some cryptocurrency and different things like that. But, you know, you look at it and you step back and you take the really 50,000 foot view and you realize, wait a minute, everything in my entire life is in the United States or Canada or the UK or Australia or whatever. And you realize that something goes wrong in that place. And every other thing in my life, I have my life, my lifestyle, my whatever, my healthcare, my financial investments, my savings, my business, my employees, my home residence, my family and their education, all these things are all tied up in this one basket. And so if something goes wrong with that basket, then all these things, you know, things can start to go wrong very quickly. And so the idea is just basically using the concept of diversification, but geographic diversification as well. Start spreading that risk around a little bit to the entire globe. And when you really start thinking globally, you realize that, in fact, the world really is a big place, and there's a lot of options and a lot of opportunities out there that for a lot of people, I think, especially in North America, they grow up and they have, you know, a view that anything outside of my home country is wrong or lower quality or, you know, whatever. And the reality is, when you actually open your mind to all the different possibilities that are out there, you find that there's just a really, honestly, a whole world of opportunity that can dramatically improve your lifestyle and your freedom and possibly your, you know, your financial position, your business opportunities, investment opportunities, et cetera. So it's just something that makes a lot of sense. And as we like to say, there's not really any downside to it at all.
Hey guys, let me just interrupt this interview real quick just to plug the show sponsor, and that is BlockFi. Now, BlockFi is doing amazing things in the Bitcoin finance space. As a matter of fact, they've cracked some really big news by bringing on the ex-CFTC chair, Chris Giancarlo, and they are one of the most transparent, most heavily regulated companies inside the United States, which gives me a lot of trust into what their services are. Now, I've recently did a video talking about how to retire off of Bitcoin, and you can do that by leveraging debt and interest against Bitcoin, and BlockFi is the number one company in the United States, or maybe in the world, to go to and use. They are leading the charge. They're paying interest on your Bitcoin if you park it with them, or you can borrow against it. Now, as I broke down in that video, you can borrow against your Bitcoin, and when you take debt against it, it's not taxable. It's not a taxable event. You can use that debt for anything that you want, including to live off of, to leverage up and buy more, or roll it into another asset. You can do something like I've done recently, like sell some real estate, put that money into Bitcoin. Now, as that Bitcoin price has risen, I'm able to borrow against it and go back and buy the same real estate or something similar. And I still own the Bitcoin, and I also own the new asset as well. Lots of ways you can do this. And BlockFi is the company that I recommend. Down in the description, I have a link that you can click on. If you choose to use that link, you can earn up to $250 in Bitcoin just for using that link. So check out BlockFi now. Yeah. So I want to dig into kind of what's going on in the developed world, like you said, North America versus other parts of the world, and then get into specifically like some things that people could do to regain some sovereignty, have that insurance plan. So we'll talk about those things, but I guess, you know, like we've said, you've been talking about this for a decade. It's never been easier to do this than it is today because of now being able to do Zoom like we're doing right now and all these things. Of course, money is all digital as well. So it's easier. But I guess someone like me who's even been paying attention to this for a decade and it's really my worldview, I still like feel like maybe I haven't done enough to diversify. And I guess probably a lot of people think of it like insurance. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't want to leave my home country and my home. But if things were to fall apart, well, I should probably have that insurance in place. Do you think that's how kind of most people look at it, or you would look at it?
Yeah, you might. Yeah. I mean, in the same way, most people don't want to write a check for a life insurance policy either. Most people don't want to write a check for their, you know, for their flood insurance, whatever. But by God, you're glad you did if the time comes and you might actually need it. The thing is, most of the things that we're talking about, I mean, insurance in many respects can cost and cost a lot of money, but a lot of things that you know, we talk about and some of the steps that people can take to, you know, to really kind of take control back over, you know, large parts of their lives don't necessarily even need to cost a thing, you know, and you know, if they do, they're incredibly low cost. So, I mean, just moving money, for example, to say, okay, you've got 100% of your assets in this one bank account that's in your home country. And so something happens, some guy decides, you know, to just file some ridiculously frivolous lawsuit because you own a restaurant and, you know, one of your, you know, you had some waiter who's 15 years old who poured coffee on one of your patrons. I say that because I did that when I was 15 working at a restaurant. you know, so now you get sued and it's like now all your entire life and your livelihood now is tied up in this thing. Because you didn't bother to take steps to diversify, protect your assets. Well, you can go and open up another bank account somewhere else. You can withdraw physical cash from a bank or gold, you know, buy gold and move it overseas to, and a lot of these things are really just a question of transferring one asset to another in a way that doesn't, in many respects, really cost you anything. It's just a question of moving some items on your balance sheet around a little bit, as opposed to even incurring any expenses. Something like a second passport is another great example. A lot of people don't even realize that they might be in line for a second passport simply because of their ancestry to parents or grandparents or something like that. And they can basically waltz into any number of embassies in a situation where they're entitled to another nationality virtually for free. They maybe got to fork over, you know, 60 euros for, you know, for a passport, to process some paperwork, and that's it. So, I mean, we're talking about stuff that, you know, we're talking about, I mean, in business and investment, we talk a lot about, I mean, this concept about, you know, value that's sort of locked up and about unlocking value and value potential. Reality is a lot of people have things they might already not even realize are on their sort of personal balance sheets. The sort of, if you think about it, you've got a sovereign balance sheet in a way, and you've got something that's on your sovereign balance sheet. Maybe you're entitled to, you know, second citizenship or something like that. It's a great example. And it's sort of this potential that's locked up there. It takes very little effort in many respects to just go and unlock that potential that you have that can be a significant increase in the quality of your life. And more importantly, to think about it like an insurance policy. A second passport is an insurance policy. A foreign bank account or gold stored in another jurisdiction, these are just another type of insurance policy to ensure that if something happens, you're going to be in a position of strength. And even if nothing bad ever happens, you're not going to be worse off for it.
Right. Yeah, I really want to dig into a lot of that stuff that you just said and get into maybe some kind of more specific stuff that people can think through about regaining that sovereignty. Before we dive into those specifics, I want to just jump back a little bit to get a bigger picture. One thing that I really like that you've always done, and I get it in your email newsletter, so everyone should just get that email newsletter if you like these topics, but I really love how you pull these historical narratives in. Fans of my channel know on most of my YouTube videos, I try to pull like a historical narrative in as well. So I love that. Really, really interests me. And so I'm curious with that kind of view that you have, you know, you have this good view of history and then at the same time where we're at today, I know you travel the world a lot. What do you think, I mean, where do you see that we're at, I guess, using history as a guide? I mean, we're at the end of the Roman Empire, like we're at the final stages of a collapse or like what, I guess, what's your worldview with that historical lens?
Well, I mean, historically speaking, Rome is always an interesting example. I mean, you've got the sort of the Western portion of Rome that lasted, you know, it was 500 years as a republic and another roughly 500 years as an empire, but then it really shifted east and lasted another 1,000 years in the east, which is kind of interesting. I mean, Byzantium was really a thing until the mid 1400s. So we really had 2,200 years of Rome. And so we can even look at, say, the, you know, the 4th century AD and see, wow, the wheels are really coming off the bus here. And yet it still lasted another 1,000 years, you know, realistically beyond that. So it's great for metaphorical examples, but I think from a historical perspective, there are probably a lot of other things, very specific instances. So I'll give you an example, like last summer when, you know, the streets were raging and everything was on fire and people were out protesting and so forth. There was a lot of, you know, people saying, you know, it's like the 1960s all over again. And I would say, well, that's actually not true. It's like to a degree. Yeah, sure. It's 1960s. But I think if you go back to the 1500s and 1600s and see the Dutch revolutionary period, for example, when the Netherlands today was under control of the Spanish Empire, this is a very interesting period of history because they had, similar issues where, Protestant revolutionaries went in, and took out all the Catholics. They ripped down all the monuments. They went around, you know, basically you had Catholic people out in the streets that were you know, maybe just sitting at a cafe or a restaurant. And all of a sudden a mob of angry Protestants would come over and beat them and assault them and these sorts of things. And so we started to see these origins of different civil wars between groups and factions. Most of them were over religion. We saw the same thing in France, where, you know, basically civil wars between the Protestants and the Catholics. And at a certain point, you kind of have to look back and say, this is so weird that these sorts of things happen. I mean, we have the benefit of hindsight to say, you know, you believed in the same God, you believed in the same book, you believed in the same, you know, basic principles. You differed on a few details related to the Eucharist and all these different things. And yet, these minor details, you agreed on like 95% of the common ground and differed on 5% of the details. And you literally went to war and killed each other over this 5% difference. And to me, that's that's kind of where we are right now, is we're in this stage of pettiness where I think people generally agree on basic things like racism is bad and it's stupid, or, I don't think anybody's there's ever stood up and said, I think COVID is great. And, you know, I think the virus should, I think more people should die of the virus. Nobody's going to say that, right? Because that's just dumb. Of course, any disease is bad. Excuse me. I think any disease is bad. I don't think most people would agree on that. Most people would probably agree that the people that are the most vulnerable should, there should be extra precautions taken, take care of people that are extra vulnerable and could die, et cetera. And then you get these details, and many of them are in some respects very trivial details, and yet they cause people to erupt in rage states of even violence. And that's where we are right now. And it's, to me, if I could tell this story briefly, there's a senator from Hawaii, Daniel, I think Inoue was how his last name was pronounced. This guy was a recipient of the Medal of Honor. And the story is extraordinary. He was, his Medal of Honor citation involves him taking this German machine gun nest. He got his right arm blown off as he was about to throw a grenade into a German machine gun nest. This is in World War II. And his arm was blown off. It still had the grenade in his right arm.
Wow.
And he reached over with his left arm, which was still attached to his body, grabbed the grenade out of the bloody stump of his hand that was no longer attached to his body, picked up the grenade and threw it at the machine gun nest, blew up the machine gun nest, saved the day, saved his men.
Wow.
And you look at something like that and you think, first of all, that's the stuff that, deep down, I think flows through the veins of American culture. And they locked that up. They locked that up. Told everybody to stay home and be afraid. And now I think they've been very successful at that. But what's even more interesting is that as Inoue was recovering from his wounds in the field hospital, he met another soldier who was recovering from his wounds, a guy named Bob Dole. And both of them went on later to become U.S. senators, and they were on the Senate floor. One was Democrat and one was Republican. And I always hate talking about political parties because it's not, I have no dog in the fight. It doesn't matter to me. I think they're kind of all the same. But they were on opposite sides. And these two guys who were both war heroes were able to come together and have civil discussion, find compromise, find common ground, and be able to figure out a way forward because they both cared about the good of the country. They differed on details, but they knew that for the most part, 95% of the way, they both cared about America and they cared what the future would hold. And they're able to find common ground. You cannot do that anymore. It's so just dreadfully polarized. Yeah. And it's not just politics. It's all over social media. And it's everything, these dividing lines. You're vaccinated or you're not vaccinated. You're masky or you're not masky. You say the names or you don't say the names. You know, all these things, it's like these huge dividing lines now that are causing rifts and fault lines across society that people can't come together and have a basic civil conversation anymore. To me, that's actually one of the scariest things. It's not even about, the erosion of our freedom and the government's locking us down. It's the inability for two human beings to have a basic conversation and just respectfully disagree and be the inability to find common ground. That's where we are, I think, as an entire planet.
Yeah.
And now, anybody that disagrees with you is a Nazi, is an idiot, is, all these things. And that's, I think, the part that is really disheartening, because you have to go back a very, very, very long way in history to find a kind of a similar disposition.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's not even just that it's so divided that you have to pick a side, but anybody who even recommends or says that maybe we should be tolerant, they get canceled. And a good example would be Ellen DeGeneres, who's, was one of the first kind of people that came out as gay and really championed, that progressive cause. And I think she took a picture with George Bush and they attacked her for that. And she made a comment about, hey, like, we could just be nice. And they canceled her over that.
Right.
Like, so even suggesting that we should even talk to the other side gets you canceled. It's insane.
Yeah.
I'm curious because you have this worldview. I know, you know, you've traveled all around the world and lived out of the country and things. You mentioned something about the stage of pettiness. And so I think about in the United States specifically, that's kind of mostly of my worldview. You know, we have all these things that people seem to be petty about, whether that be, you know, race or gender or preference and like all these things. And then I travel a lot out of the country as well. And I spend a lot of time in Mexico and Central America. And it seems like those people down there, like they're struggling just to survive. They don't have time for this pettiness. Like they don't they don't care what you call them. Like, like there's nothing you're going to say to them is going to hurt their feelings. They could care less about a sexual preference. And they don't really have that pettiness. It almost seems like it's the United States or maybe Europe, developed world that has like this big fiat currency, benefits of reserve currency status that have this pettiness, almost like there's nothing else to complain about, but you don't see it in other countries.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, pettiness is a first world problem. There's an old quote, I don't remember it exactly, but it was from John Adams who said something along the lines of, "I must study politics and war so that my son can study science and mathematics, so that his son can study music and literature." Right. I'm paraphrasing, but it's kind of more or less. And I would kind of add to that, you know, so that his great grandson, you know, can study, you know, diversity and inclusion and gender studies, basically. So you get to a point where as a society, you've become so successful that sure, people have to go and, you know, you don't have to worry about how you're going to put food on the table anymore. You know, I mean, these are the real problems that a lot of people in other cultures have to deal with. And it is, in a way, a little bit arrogant that, you know, a very wealthy society sort of expects and demands that very poor societies who honestly are just trying to struggle with figuring out how they're going to put food on the table should sort of bow to their social demands about what we think the priority of problems is. And it's kind of an arrogant thing. You're right. A lot of other societies, people, the average guy is just trying to figure out literally, how am I going to put food on the table? How do I find enough money so that my kids don't starve? Right. It's not, how am I going to figure out how to get the next upgrade for my iPhone and you know, all these sorts of things. I mean, it's not to say like people in wealthy countries don't have problems. Of course, there's plenty of people that have problems and even real problems, but you're talking about a vast percentage of an entire society that really has to struggle with paying the rent and finding food and, you know, where are they going to find clean water? And all these different things. I mean, the level of problems is so different that, yeah, I mean, it's a lot easier to be petty when you're in an incredibly rich country. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, that's what we're seeing in the US and a lot of the West.
Yeah. So that, I mean, that's a good frame that we can kind of dig in deeper. So if we start pushing in deeper, so you kind of have this idea of being sovereign and multiple flags and being able to move around the world. But at the same time, when I look through history, it seems like it's a repeating cycle of revolution, freedom, oppression, revolution, freedom, oppression. And you kind of see this over and over and over. And it's almost like this, it's a constant fight between, you know, individualism and collectivism, or today we see it as globalism and centralization. And we're seeing really globalization or centralization is really getting powerful today with the World Economic Forum and Health Organization and Trade Organization, et cetera. And we're seeing Marxism like really just have this resurgent that's like really powerful, and not just in the United States. I think you have spent a lot of time, or you have a place down in Chile, and I know like they're rewriting the Constitution and they've been taken over by Marxists. And so it seems like this globalism, centralization has just really been creeping. Marxism has been taking over even other parts of the world that aren't as developed. Do you see that? Do you agree with that? Or what do you have there?
I think I wouldn't even really call it Marxism anymore. I think what we're starting to see, you know, it's funny because if you read the Communist Manifesto and you read the principles of Marx, it's funny that Marx hated capitalism, but he didn't hate capitalists. He didn't necessarily despise the people. He thought they were misguided and he thought they were operating under a bad system. But, you know, Marx was actually benefited quite significantly from his friends who were capitalists, who were very wealthy people who kept him around because they thought he was entertaining and a fun guy. So today it's entirely different. Today, this sort of new Marxism, if we want to call it that, is sort of not only do we want to take your property, We want to take your stuff. We want to take your wealth. We want to take your income, but we want to make you out to be a terrible person too. We want to shame you. We want to ridicule you. You know, when we're willing to do whatever it takes, we'll break the law and hack the IRS and publish your, you know, the confidential information of your tax returns and so forth, simply so that we can shame you and your only crime is being successful, you know? And so this is sort of the level that, you know, and you see this now from very established political leadership. The squad and all these people that are basically, they're not Marxist. They're way beyond Marxism, because Marx would have stopped at saying, we want to take your money. Marx would have stopped at setting a high tax rate, but it's more than that, you know, because they want to shame. They despise Jeff Bezos. They'll still use Amazon. They're probably all Prime members, right? But they hate, do they hate Jeff Bezos, because he's a successful guy. Right. And so they despise that and they want to shame him. And they're willing to do, I thought, one of the most ridiculous things that really showed a sign of the times was when it was right after AOC got elected, and they went and chased this guy out of New York City when they picked New York for Amazon's HQ2. And they went and chased him out of New York City. It's like, this could have created tens of thousands of jobs, tens of billions of dollars in investment. I mean, it would have been such a huge win for the city of New York, but nope. Now it's a lose-lose now that, you know, Bezos doesn't get it, but New York doesn't get it either. And they're happy with that. They're happy to do value-destructive lose-lose deals as opposed to trying to craft win-win deals. That's not Marxism. I mean, Marx would have stepped back and said, well, that's really stupid. I mean, honestly, Marx was not anywhere near as aggressive and angry as these people are today. And it's honestly, it's a huge difference. But you do see this all over the world, this movement of a very aggressive and ridiculous form of Marxism, where people just they want the government to take care of them, and they want somebody else to pay for it. And the old saying goes, sooner or later you run out of other people's money to spend.
Hey, sorry to interrupt this video just one more time. I'm not running Google ads, so it's actually way less interruption than I normally would have on a video. And that's because it's sponsored by BlockFi. They are opening up the world of Bitcoin and financial products, offering to pay you interest on your Bitcoin, better than owning a rental property that you have to manage and control and have the risks. You can just earn interest on it, or you can leverage against it. Now, I plan to hold my Bitcoin forever and literally never sell my Bitcoin. So how do you do that? Well, if I need money, I don't want to sell that Bitcoin. I'm going to pay tax on it. All right. I'm going to end up with less, and I don't have the Bitcoin anymore. So a better way to do it is to borrow against the Bitcoin. So I've put all my money into Bitcoin. If I want to buy a car or I want to buy a house, I can borrow against it at very, very low competitive rates, get my house, get my car, whatever that may be, and get to keep the Bitcoin. Now, I've done a whole video on this. You can find it. I'll link it down in the description below, how to retire off of Bitcoin without paying taxes. And you can do that with BlockFi services. I'll link to the video down below. I'm also going to put a link to BlockFi. If you choose to click on that link to check them out, you can earn up to $250 in free Bitcoin just for using that link. And that's it. Let's go ahead and get back to the interview.
Yeah. They just don't realize it yet.
Yeah. And it seems like there's this full court press. Like I said, you're seeing it all through Central and South America right now. So there's like this full court press, like the whole world is going there. So as we start kind of moving into more specifics, you talked earlier, you threw out the term like a sovereign balance sheet. So like ways that you could become more sovereign, I suppose that's kind of what you meant. But if the whole world becomes global, you know, falls under globalization, centralization, you know, under control of the WF, et cetera, how do people think through that? I mean, I guess just try to keep as many options open as you can, or are you actively keeping a tally of places that are more friendly than others?
Yeah. So first things first is, I think you have to start looking at, it sounds a little bit esoteric, but you have to start looking at freedom as an asset. So, you know, you're an investor, I'm an investor, we're sophisticated finance guys. For a lot of your readers are very sophisticated in finance. And I think if you think about the world in terms of assets and liabilities, I mean, yeah, you've got to think about freedom as something that you would have on your balance sheet. And, you know, it, in many respects, you know, these things like your nationality, you know, where you live, your domicile, location, tax residency, et cetera, these could also be assets. They could also be liabilities, mm-hmm. right? And you know, I think it's important to take an honest, just as you would take a very honest appraisal if you were conducting due diligence on an investment deal or researching the company, you know, to really take an honest and very objective assessment of the assets and liabilities, again, on that sovereign balance sheet, using, you know, the idea that freedom is really an asset. Is the location where you are, you know, for example, where you're living, is that an asset to you or is it a liability? If it's a place that, you know, every day you're like, what are these idiots going to do today? You know, the kind of place where you're living, where you've got to step over, you know, hypodermic needles and, you know, and feces on your way to the corner store or whatever. Is that an asset or is that a liability? You know, are your local politicians the kinds of people, you know, that are saying, we're coming for you, Jeff Bezos? Right. You know, is that an asset or is it a liability? Did the police, you know, stand there while, you know, a bunch of deranged teenagers go and take over government buildings and declare an autonomous zone? Is that an asset or a liability? And it's important, I think, to take an honest appraisal of that and actually even try to quantify and value as you would any other asset, whether it's, you know, it's an intangible asset, maybe a little bit more difficult to value, like intellectual property, certainly more difficult to value than cash in a bank or the value of Apple stock, but it's absolutely an asset or it could be a liability. And I think something like a, you know, a second passport, another bank account, these sorts of things, these are assets. And the idea really is that, you know, the more options you have, if you think about it like that, that's all that means is that there's more assets on your balance sheet. So if you have the ability, for example, if you have a small portfolio of residencies in different countries that you can go and live in and, you know, work in or bring your family or whatever the case may be, each of those is an asset on your sovereign balance sheet.
Yeah.
You know, if you have, you know, all these different things. And so that's really, I think, kind of the way to look at it is as a, you know, question of, you know, what does your sovereign balance sheet look like? And think about it with respect to assets and liabilities.
Yeah, I like that. I talk a lot about, you know, the goal of, you know, investing and making money isn't just to go stockpile a bunch of money, but money gives you options. And so if I think about it like that, and to your point, there's assets that you could also own that would increase your optionality. It's very difficult right now. Like the world's changing so fast. And so like the US passport was an asset a year and a half ago. And then after the pandemic in whatever, April or May of last year, it was a liability. It was like the worst passport to have. And so it can quickly shift. And so I guess having that optionality, multiple options.
You were better off with a passport from Venezuela than you were with a US passport in like May of last year.
Right. So, yeah. So just keeping those options.
Just in terms of travel, just to be clear, just in terms of travel options and things like that.
If you need the amount of countries that would allow you to come.
The amount of countries that you could go to. Yeah. So I don't want to say Venezuela is a better place. It's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying in terms of travel, the number of countries where you could go without a visa. Yeah. I mean, you were hard pressed to get anywhere with a U.S. visa last year, with a U.S. passport last year.
Now, I know something that you've talked about for years and years is, you know, having somewhere, like you just said, like somewhere you could go. And a lot of times, preferably with, you know, some sustainable type of living, whether that be, you know, food and water, et cetera, things like that. How would the average person think through this? So like in the United States, I hear a lot of people that want to go get a ranch. I'm going to go to Nashville or, you know, Tennessee or Idaho or Nevada, whatever, and get a ranch. For me, I'm like, I don't know if I want to live on a ranch for the rest of my life. I'd probably rather live on the beach in El Salvador. How does somebody kind of think through that? Is that just personal preference or?
Well, so it is, I mean, obviously, yeah, the personal preference is a huge part of it. You've got to really have we're talking about having like a civil conversation with somebody else. The other person you need to have a civil conversation with is yourself. You've really got to have an honest, objective conversation with yourself and with your family as well, and think through, you know, what are the things that are really honestly important to us? Because the first thing you've got to recognize is you're not going to get it all. In this world, you're just not going to get it all. To have a place where you can say there's no elements of this new Marxism. They're totally fine with COVID and you know, they're very loose and relaxed and everything's fine. And it's got this and this and this and this and this. And you got these 20 things that are important to you. You're just not going to get all of those things. And so it's a question to, you know, really prioritize the things that are most important to you and figure out what you can live with, what you can't live without, and you know, kind of prioritize that way. And then it's a, you know, you've got to really start making some some very deliberate decisions about where you live. The other thing that I would really encourage people to think about is that, you know, we can talk a lot about different countries and different whatever, but honestly, local matters so much more than just about anything else. And I'll give you an example. I mean, I spent a couple of months in Cancun, Mexico earlier this year. And it's funny because Mexico is a big country. And to say Mexico is like this, well, that would be completely ridiculous because it'd be like saying that the US is like this. And as we can obviously see, what's going on in New York City is completely different than what's going on in, you know, North Central Florida, in Ocala, Florida, for example. Right. I mean, it's just totally different, right? Mm-hmm. In the same way, you know, Mexico, what was going on in Cancun versus Mexico City or Guadalajara, totally different, you know, right. And where I was in Cancun, they were smart enough to realize they need the tourists. If they don't have the tourists coming in, you know, they're going to go broke real fast. And so, you know, they put a lot of pressure on the governor and said, hey, you got to open this thing up, whatever. And they did. And it became, became a tourism hotspot again. There were tons of arrivals, people coming into Cancun. It was great. And, you know, I spent several months there and COVID did not factor into my life at all. When I was in Cancun. And that was great because that's exactly what I wanted. I just wanted a place where I could live my life. I could go to the gym. I could do whatever I wanted to do and it just not be a big part of my life. Right. And so that was a deliberate decision on my part because that was at the time, that was the kind of top priority for me. And I think it's a question of really thinking through those things and knowing yourself well enough to know, as you say, like, do I really see myself on a ranch? For the rest of my life and all these sorts of things, like you gotta think these things through. And again, the more options you have, if you can give yourself more options, the better off you are, because, you know, the idea of saying like, I'm going to have this one thing, it goes back to the original concept of putting all your eggs in one basket. And if you go all in on this one thing and go, I'm going all in on the ranch in Idaho, you know, or whatever, right? Idaho is very popular and, you know, right. My sister lives there and it's a beautiful place and, you know, nothing against Idaho. I think it's great. You know, you go all in on anything and you're setting yourself, you're assuming a certain level of risk that you might not realize you're assuming, right? Because you have just now put all of your eggs in one basket. So the idea is to find it. You like Idaho, you like the ranch thing, great, but at least give yourself another option or two, you know, and put more assets on your sovereign balance sheet. How do you do that? Well, you can go out and get, you know, a backup residency somewhere. You can go out and get, for example, Mexican residency. It's easy. It's really easy. There are so many different ways you can obtain residency in Mexico. And I'm not saying people should get residency in Mexico. I'm just saying it's an option, right, that is very easy. And once you have it, it's an asset on your sovereign balance sheet because it means that no matter what happens, you'll always have this other place that you can go. And it's a huge country and there's beaches and there's mountains and there's big cities and little towns and all these sorts of things. And maybe that's not your cup of tea. Maybe, you know, something more sophisticated is up your alley. And so maybe you would want to consider a golden visa program in Europe where you can buy real estate in one of these countries like Portugal, for example, which is, you know, they're changing the rules on that and curtailing the program. But these options exist in a lot of places. You can buy real estate and get residency there. And that gives you another option. There's a lot of debt financing available for that. And by the way, since you're in Europe, you know, euro denominated financing is available at, you know, in some respects, even 0%, possibly even negative interest rates. Wow. Right. So you have a lot of ways that you can, you know, all these programs have rules about paid in capital, et cetera. But, you know, there are always ways that you can, you know, set yourself up for, you know, maximum benefit based on the specific outcome that you're trying to achieve for yourself. And so, you know, all these, again, are assets on your sovereign balance sheet. If you have the ability to pick up and go somewhere because you have residency here or there, or whatever, like, great. And it means that you're not all in on a single option. And if you're all in on any one thing, it does mean that you're taking on some level of risk, whether you realize it or not.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. So first sit down and figure out what it is that you want. A lot of times people don't take the time to actually think through what they want. So that's important. And like I said, I've kind of thought through myself. And a lot of that is because I've spent a lot of time traveling, specifically a lot of time in Mexico and Central America. I'm actually in the process of building a house down in Mexico right now. So
where at?
It's north of Cabo, out on the East Cape.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Yeah. We've spent over the last 6-7 years, I've spent a lot of time in mainland Mexico, typically in Oaxaca, from like Puerto Escondido down to Salina Cruz. I'm a surfer, so that's where all the good waves are.
Sure.
It's a little jungly over there for some reason. I just really love the desert over there in the Baja Peninsula. And it's an easy drive if I need to. So a couple things that I kind of put into my kind of my classification.
Well, and what you're saying right now is a great example of a way to think about it. Because what do we learn from this? You're a surfer. So this is something that you really like, that's important to you. So you want to be near the beach. You've tried out a couple of different places. So you know what you like, you know what you don't like, you know the areas, you know, pretty well that you like. You think it's important to be able to have, you know, driving access from where you were in California, et cetera. So like all these things is exactly what you just said is a great framework for anybody to sort of start thinking through their own, you know, option, what I call a plan B. And really at this point, it's kind of plan B, C, D, you know, E, F, and G, as many variants of COVID as there are. You know, you should have your Delta plan and your Lambda plan, and, you know, and everything else associated with that, because you know, the more options you have, you can have, the better off you'll be. But exactly the way that you were just describing it is a great way to think about it.
And I'll tell people, you need to get out and travel a little bit. So I've been to these places. I've started to find places I do like, I don't like. And now if Mexico didn't work, I could go to El Salvador, for example. I know exactly where I would go. I know people there. I know the area. And so that gives me some options. In building out the plan B, so that's like a location. That's a big one. I guess the other big bucket would be money. And so you talk about having bank accounts in other locations. You talk about having gold potentially stored in other locations. And I'll tell you a side note for the audience too. I would say that you're probably the most responsible for getting me into Bitcoin. and that is because in 2015, I was actually in the process of using one of your attorneys that you recommended to set up a trust and a business in Panama. And I was going to put money into Panama to start working on a residency and a visa, et cetera. And I was looking at Hong Kong. I was looking at Panama, and because I wanted to get money out of the U.S. banking jurisdiction. And I'd already made plans with the attorney. We were going to go down there. It was in December of 2015. And I took another look at Bitcoin, and I've known about it for years. I've been following it. And I'm like, it's the same thing. I'm getting money out of the banking system. Mm. And I ended up buying Bitcoin. I never went to Panama, never opened that up. But anyway, that was, it was that line of thinking, like, let me diversify, let me get money out of the banking system, out of that jurisdiction to get seized or whatever happens. And so, anyway, little side note about that.
Well, it's great. Very good.
Yeah. But anyway, so then the next step, I guess, would be diversifying that money. So whether that's gold overseas, I just saw someone on Twitter, something's going viral. And someone posted that they just had to sell all their assets to get out of their country. And I think it was Canada. They were talking about getting out of Canada, but they had to sell everything because you can't really take it with you. So is that right? Money, get that diversified.
Sure. Look, money's a huge topic in and of itself. I think talk about diversifying your investments. And again, I think in the same way as somebody would diversify their investments, I know, what's his name? Jim Cramer. I don't know. I watched a show like 15 years ago, whatever. He had a segment called "Am I Diversified?" And somebody would say, like, "I own this stock, and this stock. Am I diversified?" He'd say, "No, you're not diversified." He'd push one of his noise buttons, whatever. It's funny because it's like, well, if all you own is stocks, you're not diversified. And if all you own is everything is in the US or Canada or whatever else, you're also not diversified. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole lot of asset classes, real estate, crypto, private equity, et cetera. I mean, there's so many different asset classes, and there are so many different places in the world where you really can, you know, spread your interest a little bit. And each one of those creates diversification. Also, in many respects, may create some additional income potential. We have this concept. We actually are just finishing up a report that we're sending out to our readers about this, about just thinking very, very long term. And it's interesting if you were to think very long term, if you had to invest for 100 years, 200 years, for example, would you necessarily buy an S&P 500 index fund, you know, right. Or would you want to buy a basket of funds from maybe different regions of the world, maybe an Asian fund, maybe an African fund, something like that. Look at places that have, you know, some more up and coming potential. If you have to think really far in advance,
right.
I think in general, very, very long-term thinking is a sensible way to, you know, to approach investing. And, you know, I don't think you can do that without factoring in a significant level of true diversification. Again, that goes just far beyond buying three different stocks and assuming that you're diversified. So, but I mean, this also gets into like, where is your money? Is it all in the bank? Is it in the banking system, inside and outside the banking system? Is it in different banking jurisdictions? You know, I mean, there's so many different ways to sort of diversify that. And same thing as well with your, you know, with your income. Is all of your income from one source? Is there another type of income that you can generate? Can you generate some passive income? Can you set up a business to be able to generate additional income or make some other investments that generate, you know, additional cash flow, et cetera? And can you diversify those? So I think the idea of diversification of money covers so many different topics, but it is, yeah, most definitely critically important.
All right. We're gonna wrap it up, but I want to ask you the big question.
The big question okay.
That I'm hoping to hear your answer here. So I get asked this question all the time, which is like, Mark, where are we going to go? Right. Mostly from US, you know, US people, Canadians as well, but like, where are we going to go? A lot of people feel this, like the walls are closing in. I've been paying attention because like, I want to get out before it's too late, but I don't really want to get out before I need to. But a lot of people are feeling that. I answer that question a lot. So, I get it that there's, you already kind of said like optimize for different things, but, if it's for freedom, let's just say it's for freedom. And we had to go in the next, you know, year, where do you think the top couple places would be that you would think you would go? Obviously things can change, but people might want to put on their radar.
Look, everybody's got it. I have my own list of places that I really like, but that's because they conform to my specific criteria. So,
Let's just optimize for like freedom.
Again, though, that means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. So for some people, for example, they would be focusing on where's the best place that my kids can go to school where they're not going to get brainwashed with this intellectual filth that's being traded now in so many public school systems. And for them, that's freedom. For others, it would say, where's the best place I can go where I can homeschool my kids and pull them out of the system entirely? That's okay. A different type of freedom, right? For some people, it's where can I go? Let's say as a wealthy individual who doesn't, you know, want to feel the constant onslaught of the angry rabid Marxists coming after me versus others, where can I go where I don't have to worry about vaccine passports or where can I go without having to worry about having to put on a mask? This is really the kind of specificity and level of detail that you would want to think through in terms of, you know, the priorities and the things that are important to you. For me, for example, I ended up in Mexico very deliberately because as I mentioned, I didn't want COVID to have much of an impact on my life. A big part of that was because I knew I was going to have a child. And I didn't want, most importantly, my number one priority was for COVID to not have any impact on the birth of my child. Ergo, not be in a place where the doctors or the hospital was going to have some stupid policy to say, dad can't be in the delivery room, because I would have wrecked holy hell on everybody if I wasn't allowed to be in the delivery room for the birth of my child. Right. And so I wanted to be in a place where I knew it could be very high quality medical care. And it just wasn't going to be a factor. And so that's exactly why I ended up very specifically where I was, where I ended up in Mexico. So, you know, it's maybe not the answer. I know that, I get these questions. A lot of people say, well, they're looking for like this kind of exact, like 1, 2, 3, you know, list. And I think my answer is always disappointing because it, you know, and I hate to say it depends, but it really, it's all up to you as the individual. And I think in your case, your list, you know, you're going to have certain criteria. I'm not a surfer, right? So there's going to be certain things on your list.
Yeah. I was just thinking list. Like, you know, Eastern Europe, for example, like they seem to be coming out of communism, maybe not super quick to rush back into it. Maybe they would remain.
Sure. I mean, if we want to look at sort of like, really big picture, broad generalizations. Yeah. I think, there are a lot of places that have had their really nasty experiments in the past, that haven't gone very well. I think those guys sort of are starting to realize that, You know, we don't want to go back to that. And right. So ironically, yes, I mean, there are places in Eastern Europe that, you know, they're just not interested in Marxism. But some places in Eastern Europe, you know, for example, in the Baltics, where they might not be interested in Marxism, but they are more interested in COVID lockdowns, for example, and they like vaccine passports. Then you have places like Sweden, you know, that were relatively chill with respect to COVID, but, you know, they're very high tax. I don't think Sweden is Marxist at all. I don't think it's socialist. I think it's a very market-oriented economy, just one with very high taxes, you know, but they're a high tax place, but one that doesn't necessarily embrace the fanaticism of public health policies that have infected the rest of the world's, you know, officials and authorities. So, like it's like I said, it's just very sort of specific to what everybody's, you know, individually looking for. But the reality is that what you're looking for, you're not going to be able to find a place that ticks all of your boxes anymore. That might have been the case 5 years ago. You could have found a place that ticks all your boxes. You're just not going to be able to do that anymore. But you're going to be able to find a place that ticks the most important ones if you're very specific with yourself about what you can live with and what you can't live without. And again, you just have to think locally, because it might even entail a dramatic improvement in your life and lifestyle just by moving across the county line.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Well, with that, we're going to go ahead and ahead and wrap it up. I appreciate that. So much good information. Like I said, I've been following you for a long time. I'd recommend everyone else do as well. So anywhere that you want to direct people to follow along?
No, I mean, our just the main website is just sovereignman.com. So
you got it. We'll go ahead and link to that down below. Okay. I know you got a YouTube channel as well, so we'll link to that as well. And with that, we'll.
I think we quit YouTube after we did a podcast a week or two ago about COVID, and then suddenly the gal that runs my company said that YouTube had apparently temporarily suspended us. So so I don't think we're really on YouTube anymore.
All right. Well, then we'll just link. We'll link to your website down below.
Okay.
All right. Fair thanks enough. So much.
Okay. All right. Thanks, buddy.